Our gospel lesson for this morning is from Luke 19, beginning with the first verse. This is the familiar story of Zacchaeus. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome Jesus. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today, salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God. Dennis Rogers wrote about his experience seeking justice for the death of his daughter. "Courthouses reek with the stench of loss. Good things rarely happen there. Our system of justice is adversarial by design. And that means that every time someone wins, someone else loses. There can be no ties. The combatants, and it's hard not to think of it as war, are gathered because something bad has happened. Perhaps a headline-grabbing murder or drug deal. More often it is tragic. Divorce, bad checks, a fatal car wreck. Justice can be as elusive as smoke and just as acrid. That acrid, shabby place was Zacchaeus' place. Zacchaeus was not only a tax collector, but chief tax collector in a rich town. That meant that the stench of the courthouse clung closely to his garments. Zacchaeus was your neighbor who would drag you into court, caring little about justice. All he cared about was how to get money, and he didn't have to use legitimate means. Here's how the system worked. If we think about a mob, a gang, and not about some kind of structure of government, we'll be closer to tax collecting in the Roman Empire. As chief tax collector for a city as wealthy as Jericho, Zacchaeus would have been a major player in the Herodian collaboration with Rome. Tax collectors paid the taxes due on assigned territory, and then they could use whatever means at their disposal to reimburse themselves at a profit. The Roman method of taxation is actually credited as one of the causes for the fall of Rome. Cahill writes about this. "Eventually, the Roman approach to taxation led to desperation. Senators and wealthy landowners were exempt from taxes. Therefore, the disappearing middle class and the poor were increasingly squeezed to support Rome's rapacious appetite. So the tax collectors, like Zacchaeus, out of desperation, took whatever they could, however they could take it, in order to pay increasingly unpayable dues." For this and other reasons, Cahill argues, Rome was doomed. In the scenario that Luke plays out, actually everyone is doomed. The tax collector is doomed. The poor whom he defrauds are doomed. Law abiders are doomed. And even Jesus at the end is doomed. Dennis Rogers writes, "Justice may not be much to look at, but it's all we have. The law, remember, started out to be good. It was God's good gift to Israel, but it could not save. Luke's depressing drumbeat started many chapters ago with a man asking to be justified. So he says, "Who's my neighbor?" When your religion is the law, then everything is about justification. And nearly every story leading up to Zacchaeus is about somebody trying to justify themselves. In today's lesson, a tax collector is saved, and law abiders are dismayed. For what else is there? If they are not righteous, if they cannot justify themselves, then they are cut off from the order where everyone knows their place. Justification is everything when the law is all we have. The word oppression, because this is what this has become, a terribly oppressive society. The word oppression is defined this way: narrowness, to choke, to envelop, to enwrap, to be hemmed in, constricted. Oppression is viewed in our Bible as a kind of spatial hemming in or imprisonment. So to be rescued from oppression is to move out into the open. The word yesha, salvation, in Hebrew is a causative meaning. It means to make it spacious for one who is constricted. Luke's literary artistry illustrates both the condition of God's people, oppression, and the nature of their salvation, spaciousness. However, salvation is not possible in the world as it is constructed for Zacchaeus, where the law is all there is, and where our very life and community depends on constant self-justification. Something must change. Something's got to give. Something has to die for a new future to be possible. Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house. A hole has been punched in the prison wall of justification. The lungs fill with air, and life is pouring in for Zacchaeus. A whole world is opening up. It is spacious. Like Joshua before him, Jesus comes to Jericho, and the walls come a-tumbling down. The walls that denied life to everyone, oppressor and oppressed alike. Jesus says, salvation, spaciousness has come to this house, for the Son of Man has come to seek and save the lost. And the walls came tumbling down. In this spacious place, we find out what God is like, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. And in Zacchaeus, we see what salvation looks like. Jesus, remember, does not ask Zacchaeus to do anything. But Zacchaeus, in this spatial, hopeful place, gulps in the air of freedom, and he is irrepressible. His joy will not be contained. He restores what he has taken fourfold and gives half of all he has to the poor. His confined life is burst open. New opportunities are called forth from him. Salvation, healing, restoration have come to his house and through him to his community. We are now at a time in our national life where there is and will be an urgent need for restoration. A time to create spaciousness. It is good to let this lesson equip us for the myriad reconciliations that are needed in a bitter and polarized time. Miroslav Volf, who Rick and I heard lecture 2 weeks ago, outlines 5 steps to reconciliation. First, we must remember rightly. This is the Zacchaeus, if I have defrauded anyone. Volf writes, some ways of remembering keep resentments and hatreds alive. provide justification for future harm. So remembering rightly means to remember wrongdoing truthfully. This is the first step in reconciliation, and without it, all further steps will falter. Why does truth matter and matter so much? Because every untruthful memory of a wrong committed and suffered is an unjust memory. Unjust towards victims, unjust towards perpetrators, and almost always both. When we misremember, we wrong other people, and we do so irrespective of whether we remember untruthfully as perpetrators, victims, or third parties. When we misremember, we don the mantle of false innocence in order to preemptively protect ourselves. Perpetrators' memories are famously short. They flee into the future, eager to close the book on the past, as F.W. de Klerk urged after the end of apartheid in South Africa. By forgetting the past, they seek to erect a facade of innocence. But hidden away, the past gains power over the perpetrator. Painful as the truth may be, only truth can set perpetrators free. Victims' memories, on the other hand, are long. When I did my interviews in black churches for my doctorate, I found memories that went back to the 1600s, carefully repeated generation after generation after generation. They review a past of suffering and humiliation that can usurp much of their identity and rob them of a future, even pushing them to becoming perpetrators themselves. The light of truth can set victims and perpetrators free from the dead hand of the past. It can set victims free of resentment and perpetrators free of guilt, which brings us to step two, forgive. Forgive. Put it simply, to forgive means not to count the wrongful deed against the wrongdoer. So we name the wrongdoing, we condemn it, and then we give the wrongdoers the gift of not counting it against them. Freed from the burden of the past, both victims and perpetrators can embark on a new future. Third, apology. Wolf writes that we must remove the veil of silence behind which we hide wrongdoing so that we can bring the moral stain of our misdoing into the light of truth. To apologize, we must mean what we say. It is hard to apologize and to do it genuinely. We hesitate to admit wrongdoing to ourselves, much less acknowledge it publicly. We feel that unacknowledged wrong is somehow unreal wrong. Yet the only path to freedom in a future is contrition, confession, and apology. Both sides benefit from apology. It elevates victims and frees the wrongdoer, returning both of them to a posture of respect. Four, repair the damage. Zacchaeus gave half of all he had to the poor and then promises to return fourfold to those who had been defrauded. As Wolf observes, refusal to repair the damage renders the apology hollow. It invites the suspicion that the purpose of the apology was to repair the wrongdoer's reputation on the cheap. Five. Step five is embrace. Perpetrators' apologies and reparations, as well as victims' forgiveness, are acts of liberation. The past, though unalterable, no longer colonizes the present. Having escaped captivity, both are now unburdened toward the future. These five steps, truth-telling, forgiveness, apology, reparation, and embrace, are about enacting a shared commitment towards a moral order. Let me say that again. Enacting a shared commitment towards a moral order that is essential for our life together. Let's face it, Wolf writes, we're stuck with each other, and therefore we should be pushed to reconcile. Plus, we're stuck with our own alienation from ourselves if we aren't willing to return to each other. He concludes, if we are able to join each other on this path to reconciliation, then each thing in the world is a new relationship marked by love. Each distant star, every gentle touch, each face, every whiff of freshly plowed earth, in sum, every good and beautiful thing shimmers. We experience ordinary things as extraordinary, as gifts of our divine and loving God, and therefore we rejoice in them all the more. Our joy, like Zacchaeus, is irrepressible. We cannot contain the outpouring of gifts for the benefit of the community. Salvation has come to this house. A new and spacious future is opening up before us. If Zacchaeus can become God's instrument, breathing the air of freedom and stepping into the spacious place of future possibility, so can you. And so can I. The best is yet to be. Thanks be to God. Amen.